private meetings just with the chief of delegation. We have what we call many fundraisers where they're military fellows, scientists, Paul, General Ellis, and myself talking in our office. I think we're going to have to try to increase that sort of talk and decrease the speeches if you want to surprise. I think it would be more in our security interest if we got a zero ban on ADMs in connection with offensive defense.
Not at all.
Not at all. Connection with.
If I could interrupt you, Terry, for one moment. We asked if we kept on all this interaction, and I think you know, you have the budget thing. I know the reasons, but I think that's the reasons, but. I think that all of us have to have in mind we're going to have to the person they think, well, so it's only $1 billion a year. This is the kind of a weapon that really is mass collection, not bad ABMs. All of us know it well, and so we'll ban ABMs, so it's got a probability without verification. Even assuming all that, then the race still goes on. Race goes on in areas, that's the real problem. You can't, banning the ABMs would accomplish nothing in terms of the escalation of the hardening, all the rest. All of that adds to giving nobody just an ABM ban. But the argument is strongly made, you know, in some quarters of we're too rigid, and I. Do you expect them to come up with a just a straight in this man the ABM desk? That's going to be their first move. What's your answer going to be?
Well, I think that as we deal with congressional committees, all I think will support this conclusion that we have gotten a lot of flack from certain characters like Symington, especially, who just can't understand why we don't sign.
Who?
Stuart Symington. Why we don't sign an ABM when we come back tomorrow. But after talking to three or four committees, I think that we have made a dent on these fellows by pointing out that a bird can't fly on one wing, and if you try to freeze defenses and let the offensive then run completely free, and it does run completely free, and they continue to build big missiles aimed at our Minuteman, that agreement wouldn't last very long. Life expectancy would be pretty short.
But I don't think we're going to have too much to do with it. You know.
And especially after this information with the freeze this morning, it seems to me that there's much of the scene is going to be taken out of the room.
It saves a lot of problems, but I wish we wouldn't have had the damn information. Saves some problems with it as far as the congressional debate, but it's very bad information for us to have because it does complicate to a greater extent than I thought was possible our whole balance. We're going to be in a position where our Minuteman fields are going to be completely vulnerable by 74, 75, and we probably will only have a survivability of 200 to 300 missiles. And this is very difficult position for our country.
Let me ask question one. The information is bad or putting out the information?
No, the information is bad.
All right. Okay.
You recall, sir, you authorized us to table an alternative ABM proposal, a quick ban or a national command authority. Now, it seems to me that if we negotiate a national command authority limited to Washington, go out and demolish safeguard. The Soviets don't have to take down anything. And then the next day we go up to Congress and say, now we'd like to have $1.9 billion to build an NCA. We run into a great deal of skepticism about that. We've already gotten some of this on the Hill.
Nobody wants to compare to Washington.
So that we could end up in a situation as we did in the 1920 naval treaty where we never built up to treaty strength. So that's one reason. It seems to me that if you foresee a world without ABMs, where our weapon systems could penetrate assuredly, this would be a better military situation. And one in which both sides had an NCA system, but its capabilities were uncertain, and we were always worried about it being hooked into SAM systems and making them into SAM ATM capable systems. I think that for once, we have a wonderful psychological opportunity. We've always had to face Soviet proposals to go further. We wanted to ban the bomb, but we couldn't do it because of verification problems. Here, the broader restraint of the ban, I think, would be easier to monitor than the NCA proposal.
A ban on
it? Yes.
This is not just a sort of offensive defense.
Oh, yes.
Together,
yes.
This way out of law.
In a joint, in an offensive defense control rate.
You mean a numbered deal? That's right.
Now, as far as that you could. So I think.
Although you still. The verification still indicates you don't. You can't help on burning.
Yeah, but this wouldn't affect the ABM. And I think we could. I think they could support this. Feel high confidence that an ABM ban could be monitored.
If you have them tear down both their hen houses and dog houses, I believe that's true. But if you don't have to tear them down, then you can't be monitored.
Well, then an NCA can't be monitored, a fortiori, and
sure.
The type of deal that Mel was talking about of having some of the systems out west as the matching system can't be monitored. I don't think we want to get into that position. We have, I think, taken the position that an NCA can be adequately monitored. So what I'm saying is a ban could be even better monitored than an NCA.
Would you permit the radars in the ban or not?
I would stick to the August 4th proposal, which limits the number specifically of radar. I do not agree with the Joint Chiefs position, which curiously enough is the same as the Soviet position, that you should have a circle around Moscow, and anything you want in the way of radars can be deployed in that. I don't think that's safe enough. I think we ought to spell out what radars would be.
Well, I don't agree with that position either, but I do feel that you have to, because we have none of the radars, you have to have some trade-off in that area. You have to have that.
That's in our building, our August 4th building. So that for a number of reasons, psychological, economic, congressional relations, and I think just on the strategic balance, we'd be better off with a ban on ABMs in connection with an offensive defensive deal than either NCA or the type of deal that Mel is foreshadowing of keeping some of the safeguards. Now, I hope I'm not going on too long here. I'm hoping that this is a complicated panel. I think that we can, without any real difficulty, make a try for what Mel is talking about, of a national command authority system, not in Washington. I don't know how far we'll get, but we can certainly push hard on that.
The question really is, let's stay where we are. Stay where we're going.
I take it that's what it's about. Some of the Minuteman sites.
Three or four Minuteman sites.
And then we could go ahead and just hire.
I think three or four is too high. I would think maybe two is about what the traffic might bear.
All right, start with four.
I think in addition to that, if we propose a preference for a ban instead of NCA, that would put us in a positive position as opposed to the Soviet proposal for NCA. We're presently a little bit on the defensive, although this latest intelligence sort of changes that. But if we say, look, let's not go to what you're talking about, but you have offensive, defensive vehicles with a whole hog and ban these things psychologically, in a better position.
Listen, man, keep in mind that Jerry again is not talking about this solely. This is in connection with an agreement that covers offensive missiles as well.
Now, my last point, sir, is on this question of timing. Our present proposal has an escape clause at any time. When we are vital interests requiring, and I take it that if we felt that our Minutemen were becoming over vulnerable, that would be considered a vital interest. That wouldn't be just a marginal interest. So that would support clearly such an escape. In addition to that.
The difficulty there, Jerry, I think it might be the conversation, fairness, that if, for example, as a result of such a clause, we were to act at that time, that would be virtually like a declaration of mobilization. Whereas if, on the other hand, you act because a treaty comes to an end, I don't know whether it's even possible what you're talking about, but I do think that if either side decides, well, the hell with it, we're going to go off and start building these things again, then off you go. Whereas
I would hope, Mr. President, we wouldn't go into an agreement unless it was perfectly clear in both sides' minds that this escape clause was a real thing, and we would not feel politically we couldn't get out of this.
Yeah, if the escape clause might be a real thing, you have the choice of the escape clause and agreement. It's not stated, and I think there's something to be argued on the other side.
I agree.
You mean a time stated at which time you renew?
I have grave doubts that you can negotiate. Also, I have grave doubts that it would be in our interest to negotiate a deal limited to 5 years after which there was no agreement unless you negotiated a new one. For instance, if you could negotiate a fire on ABMs, you then go out and destroy all the safeguards. You wouldn't know whether after 60 months you had a deal or not. In fact, you would know that you haven't negotiated a new deal. I don't think the Soviet Union is going to enter into limitations that have just a 60-month life expectancy. And I don't think we should be willing to reorient a lot of our things for such a short term as that. Now, if you have an escape clause, and you also have a provision that after 5 years or whatever years you want, either side can finish it. I think that is perhaps negotiable. But to say there's no agreement after 5 years unless both sides negotiate a new one, I don't think that we can get that.
Sir, I don't think you say that in chance to negotiate a new one, but it would just be extended by agreement. But the present one would be extended by agreement. It seems to me your argument is slightly inconsistent. If you say it's recognized by both sides, you get out of it any time. The suggestion that I made merely means it would be easier politically to get out of it after 5 years. Otherwise, it's like NPT, that has a 90-day determination provision in it. But any nation that applied that provision would take a hell of a beating internationally. So I think it's this one, there are a lot of things you can say about it, on the termination clause. You can point out the difficulty of verification that might appear and all that, and say, as you will, this will provide at the end of 4 years.
That's certainly a long way down the road.
Anyway, talking about what we do. Let me ask you something regarding your objection. Say, in the space of a couple of years, how many more summers do we have?
No, seriously, is it none of us, we're all practicing. I think we all realize that lacking a man who is insane and at the head of either government, who's insane enough to scare the hell out of everybody else so that his insanity rules, you're gonna have a situation where two major powers are gonna enter some sort of agreement sometime. That's my view. It's a question of some, you agree with that. Now the question is, Are we looking at 2 years, 3 years, 4 years? What should we look at? I share the view of Allaire. First, if you want it in 6 months, the way is to appear not to want it in 6 months. Don't press too hard. Let's not go like that. On the other hand, just speaking to that point, are you as pessimistic as others about this? When do you see them coming to any kind of agreement? Or us? You're talking about 1 year, 2 years, 3 years? Not to be held to it, but just in terms of where we are.
Sure. And ask for the excuse. I have during four seconds, please, I want to schedule before I do, be here, and I think I'd be there for that seating, and proceeding on the long-term bond.
I said the other day, every time I call Secretary of State, you know, before the Congress, you're saying through the Secretary, that's not through the Secretary of Treasury.
Go ahead.
I'll be, well, not calling, be excused up there, but.
No. They always, I couldn't agree more with you, I might add.
My legs are above for me.
They always love to talk to the new man in town.
Thank you, Mr. President.
You'll win. I just,
Well, I would say.
I think we should all talk in terms of, well, let me put it this way. We realize that we have a grave, we have a political problem at home. There are those people, there's Jack was, he's sort of basically all the folks that say, good God, we got some power in this man. Or at least limited. And everybody wants to, and there are those who are terribly discouraged about the relationship. If they read these figures, if they really read what we had in that foreign policy report and looked at that chart, it would scare the hell out of them.
That's right.
Really, it would scare the hell out of them. Now, eventually it will be read. Because a man, incidentally, I have the greatest respect for Scoop Jackson. He is going to make this point. He's going to make it against the Senate Dubs, who are running against him. And he's going to win on that point eventually. Big man, because they're going to be talking about, oh, no ABM, no this, that, the other thing. He's going to show the numbers. They got this much throw weight, they have this many numbers, they've got this and that. We've got a few things too, as we point out. But who's going to give the reason kind of argument on the other side? Because those problems he's talking about, they aren't going to know of them. Or at least they won't have studied it. But nevertheless, what I'm saying is this, that I think if we have sort of a double problem. We must hold out hope. Not Pollyannish hope, because that's not misleading. Hope that, well, we're talking, the discussions are serious, which they are. They're non-polemical, which they are, etc. We have great differences because our interests are different. We're working hard to protect our interests. We think that in the end, we think that down the road that we're going to have an agreement. We're not saying when. Now, that's sort of the line I've been taking. Is that the right line? What do you say when they ask you?
I think trying to give you a precise answer to stop this negotiating process may be just as hard as to get out of the room and talk about what either side is going to want to take the onus for breaking out of this sort of process. And that isn't too bad because even though it's not producing an agreement, I don't think it's doing very much harm as long as we go ahead with our military business as we should. Having said that, it seems to me that in the process of 1 year, this year, we ought to be able to tell whether it's been in sight for you.
Mr. President, all I have is that I think that there's a good possibility we'll have an understanding. I will very much agree when I think if you look back over the history of mankind, making an agreement that you spell out black and white and sign it, very, very difficult. Now, you can do it on mission, like when the test ban and secret, where you're not planning to do anything anyway.
What does it mean?
This is going to be very difficult. Maybe we'll get an agreement, but I think it's more likely to result in some kind of understanding.
Yeah, the sea gets and the rest, we all go down. I mean, that's really the greatest act I've ever seen. Going down in the State Department of Authority, all the companies are all there, all the cabins are there. And the less an agreement means, the more you make it appear that it does mean something. That's correct.
Well, I mean, I didn't mean that, though.
What did you say? No, I thought it meant something, you know, was something, and after all, it was down the road, it means something. At least that's what we claim. Let me say this, that I would like to do, Jerry, what you've done before. I'd like to do a little thinking. Maybe I get a couple of ideas before you. We're talking now about the, this is the D.
You have the Friday morning takeoff.
Friday morning takeoff. heading down there for the weekend. Anyway, Wednesday, I'll get a couple of thoughts in mind, and I'll discuss it based on our conversations here. But I just add one other point before we discussion, because I guess others have got a plan at 10 o'clock today, I'm learning. It's a difficult point from the standpoint of the psychology of the American people here, which we've got to wake up to. Jack hears it all. Well, Jack, not being a unilateral disarmament, as many of those who talk to him are, but Jack, knowing the world as it is, and knowing Europe as it is, and he was in with his crowd and talked to me about Europe, and knowing the Europeans, know the truth of what I'm just about to say. First, when the world, and by the world I mean the American people, the people generally in the world, those people that rely on the credibility of the American attorney, Stalin the other day, for example, said, well, we can never, break our constitution and so forth and so on. We've always got to defend the American security term. The Europeans, they talk about their little bang and so forth and so on. It doesn't mean a damn thing. It's prestige right, it means something. But they know very well that what really is back of NATO and the rest is what we've got. You all know that. We're talking to the fellow from Senate was in here, a highly intelligent man. Highly intelligent. He ought to be in some international. I wish we could get him enough.
Take your class, please.
Boy, what a trade. You talked, they got that mission to Mars. We could send him on that. But anyway, we could go on that. The fun we're really getting them down here is that when the world, without some jingoistic, when the people of the United States, let's just limit it to that, as well as those allies, the sophisticates in our allies abroad, those that depend upon the American nuclear, when they realize that the United States is the second strongest nation in the world, that's going to have a very detrimental effect on the Secretary of States and the rest of us in terms of our duties. Now, that's why I tried in my few little questions here to bring out a point, which I know Jerry has made, that all of this is a balance. First, when you talk about who is first and who is second, the question is, what does each mean? We are a sea power. They are a great land power. We do not have, thank God, either Mexico to the south or Canada to the north does not present to us the enormous threat that the Chinese divisions present to them. So we don't have to have 34 divisions, guaranteeing on the other border. All these things we know. So what is sufficient for them in terms of deterrence, in terms of power and so forth, is quite different from what is sufficient for us. And all this we realize, that's the sophisticated argument we have to make. Yeah. There are the numbers. Three times as much throw weight, 25% more numbers in terms of missiles, at least in terms of ADMs in place, more than we got, although ours are going to be better. And nuclear submarines, they will pass us. The latter part of 74 equals the early part of 74. Maybe ours are going to be better tomorrow. So be it. I think it's very important, Mel, and I would hope that you would do this, that this time, while for purposes naturally of being sure that we get the appropriations that we need, and this $76 billion, as you know, is actually a cut in our actual strength, even though it was $74 billion last year, because the increase in costs and the increase in manpower really mean is that we're going to get less defense for more money. And that's the way it is. Now, if it happens that we believe that the 76 is the right figure for what we're trying to do at this time, but if we had not cut all over those Asian areas in that chart you showed, we'd be out of the ballpark. If our cuts costs in Vietnam today were $22 billion a year, if they were the year we came in, rather than $11 billion a year, they're going to be less, we couldn't make the 78 be anything. The point that I make, however, is that there are some areas where the United States still has some advantage. I was surprised to find a
my study of the foreign policy report, the department, all of your people working on.
I was surprised to find that, it, so far as our NATO strength is concerned, as against the Warsaw Pact, it is really greater than theirs. We have more numbers. Now, I always assumed it was otherwise because I was thinking the Russian landmass, but I hadn't realized, of course, the Russians are cut in half. They got 34 divisions on the other side, the rest on this side. But the Warsaw Pact versus NATO, so we did pretty good there.
Anyways, economically as well.
Right. Well, economically, we're enormously ahead. Enormously ahead. And all you have to look when you see Japan, the third strongest industrial nation in the world, you see what a pop they've got. The other point that I make is this. I get back to the Navy. Admiral, first of all, let's be sure that naval power remains adequate, up to date, and the rest. And second, in Melanie, your testimony, I think it's very important for you constantly to emphasize that in terms of the Navy, conventional Navy, not this thing, nuclear submarines and the rest, that despite the Soviet growth, despite the fact that they're moving now in the Mediterranean and the rest, that the United States has an enormous advantage. We have it in terms of naval power around the world. We've got aircraft carriers and all the other things. They don't have our, if it's, this is not true, Tommy, I don't want to say that it's true.
No, that's, we have an advantage, there's no question.
You see, the point that I make is, Bill and I were talking about this the other day, the point that I make is that you create the impression that overall, the United States is now number two rather than number one.
So we think in those terms these days. Part of it is because of football, baseball, basketball, even that those two clowns that are fighting tonight. I mean, it's going to be number one or number two for Frazier and Alley.
Well, so that's very important. But in terms of the United States and Soviet Union, you look at the Japanese, you look at the Germans, you look at our European friends, you look at the at those that have no clout at all. So here, since the Soviet Union astride the military complex that the world recognizes makes it the strongest power in the United States, let's even assume that we can say, oh yes, but we've gotten enough to deter action against us. It is very important not that we talk in terms of the fact, in terms, and we have not talked that way. The World Report is very well written in this respect, in my opinion. We don't talk in terms of the fact we are superior to anybody else, but we do say, look here, we have enough in terms of sufficiency to deter anybody, any enemy, to defend the United States, to keep all of our treaty commitments, to meet our commitments in Europe and Asia, et cetera, et cetera. And we intend to maintain enough. Right. And I think it's very important for, if you can, to talk optimistically about those things. And also, as I say again, particularly on the naval power, we have simply gotten to see that that is not eroded. Because that's the one area where their gains are quite substantial, are they not?
The land that they have is tremendous in the naval area, but of course our biggest increase in our budget is in the naval area too. We have $750 million more in there this year than we had last year for ship construction. So we are moving out on that and trying to keep our position intact.
This is no problem of yours, Jerry, but you can see the enormous political problem that presents in the United States, and it presents diplomatically. I've often recounted the fact that the Dutch foreign minister a year ago, a year and a half ago, and we just gave him the lid of what could happen in 3 or 4 years. He said, if the leaders of Europe knew this was true, they would be frightened to death. Of course, he was thinking in terms of number one and number two. Now, as a matter of fact, the United States, despite the fact that the Soviet Union has moved ahead in certain areas, the United States has not helped us. This is in terms of economic strength and what we are capable of doing in terms of our conventional naval power, in terms also of our nuclear sophistication. the United States is still able to take care of itself and take care of itself. I think that's the point that we've got to get constantly.
Jack, I just want to say one thing about that.
Maybe I'm wrong. I don't want to call it.
No, about 2 years ago, I was in Tehran and talking to the Shah. And he was talking about the great umbrella we had, but I knew about what was developing with the Soviet Union, and I told him that was why I'm not violating any secrets at all. And he said, just please, he said, if the world knew that, he said, what, there would be a race between Bonn and Paris to Moscow. That was his first reaction. And it was that concept that just confirms what you're saying. I don't want to interrupt. I don't know whether you have to turn with that.
No, we're not.
I just want to thank you for being here. I think this is the first, at least in the more recent CDs, I've attended as chairman of your committee. You made one or two references to that committee and the pressures that we're under. They're not so very heavy at the Kansas system. But everybody seems to be talking about what my committee does and what reports we're giving out. All the leaks seem to be on the dove side. I don't know just why that is.
Yeah, we're doves.
But I want to defend my committee. This committee,
I got a shotgun if you want.
The committee is not a bunch of do-gooders. It's not a group of professors or academicians. It's people who have been to the wars. You've got Larry Norstedt, Dean Ruskin. I won't go through the whole list, but it's a pretty impressive group of political, and we've had over 50 meetings, and we've had as much as some of the others around here have had, but we've had a very good presentations. We're not naive, I think, in this area.
Sure.
I've been playing around with defense and disarmament for a long time, even before World War, between two World Wars, I was disarmament. But anyway, I just want to say that I think their judgments are very objective. I'm very much impressed with the way they work. We have some views that I think differ with some of those that you've expressed this morning. The thing that I keep coming back to in my feel about this situation, having been on both sides of this thing for so many years, that I feel that if the security of the United States would be enhanced today, if we could get an agreement, which was a zero ABM agreement, plus a ban on MERS, and I'm conscious of all the difficulties of verification regarding MERS, together with a limitation on the offensives. I believe that this is the area in which the dangers of great potential escalation occur, or are threatening at this point. And if we could cut into that, I think our prestige, talking about the balance of power, which is, I guess, what you're talking about, Mr. President, and the impact, the conceptual balance of power, I think if we took a move in this direction, which everybody could see was made that we were serious in regard to this disarmament affair, but we were not going to give away one whit in terms of the security of the United States, I think it would be very convincing that such a move as that would be increase our security, and it would, maybe if you at a certain point got involved in it yourself, would show our seriousness. Jerry even talked about these trade-offs. I think they're all paid. He was comparing this other sort of business. I don't mean to be too disparaging about it. But I think something along that line, I think we ought to study this matter of verification of MERS, because, as I say, I think it's in that area that we have the greatest threat, the greatest menace of an enormous increase in our budgetary expenses and no security really for it, because it's unstable. In other words, you get close to unstable. In regard to the prospects for an agreement, I would say they're pretty good. I have the feeling that the Soviet Union would give a good bid for the codification of the concept that they are on a parity with the United States.
Yeah.
This means a great deal to them, the very reason that you're talking about. We've got to do something to counter that. At a given point, we can do it politically as well as militarily. But I have a feeling that there's a great urge on their part for that. It was somewhat the same as the non-proliferation treaty. But this was the greatest amount of talk about it. You're going to lose them. You couldn't lose them you couldn't have pulled them back with a two pair of mules. That was to their ultimate advantage. I think it's a little bit less conspicuous this time. But I think it's still clear that they would like to have an
agreement which did codify parents, values of the parents.
But I'm not too happy about this agreement. Certainly, I don't want an agreement for agreement's sake. I have a feeling that we could convince the world that we were really moving into this area, convince the people of the United States at the same time that we weren't giving up on their bit in terms of our security. As I have to feel, if you did have a ban on ABMs or zero ABMs, if you did limit MERS effectively, I'm not getting into the verification business now, if you did reduce your limitation on your ICBMs, I believe this, the whole area we're talking about would be more stable. I think our security would be convincing to everybody. And I think the political initiative would have a great deal to do with the prestige and the image, the strength that the United States has before the world, which is not only limited to what we can do and show in terms of hardware, but in terms of our initiatives and our leadership.
Can I ask one question? On MERS, you reported at an earlier time they've shown a particular interest in MERS. I guess because we got it and they haven't, said it. So,
our proposal was not very attractive to them because it called for some site inspection, which is an
athlete. Has there been you would suggest a ban on MERS without inspection?
Well, I would suggest testimony that we've had. Yeah. And that we've had all kinds of things. The testimony that we've had is that if you could have a ban on testing of MERS, you'd have a substantial factor here. You may not have guarantees in regard to that, but probably if you could have a burn on testing, we could detect testing. And if we detected testing, we think that it would be very, very low to start a all-out strike on the basis of the limited testing that they that had available. But they would have to have full, complete range testing in order to think, ever think of taking the first strike against
this. Let me say this, I think it's not only important, Jack, you said, not only what we do in this field, what we propose, but what is said so that the world leadership is pretty clear. I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, and I've talked to various people around the table about that, and I know something in the way of the statement before you go back, so that this sounds like it gets a little lift, and then you go on, and it's there. The second thing I wish to say is this, let us try in this instance, because the first is the truth, that's perhaps our best reason. Let's try in this instance to, once we do get the position going and so forth, to try to salt down all those stories to the effect, well, this was a victory for state, or a victory for ACLA, or a victory for defense, or the victory for the Joint Chiefs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a victory for nobody. We are all trying to get the very best thing we can. Who knows what the best answer is? And
it's so mixed up and nobody can.
Well, the difficulty is so many people around this table read those damn columns and they think that it worries them, so let's not worry. We can, I understand, I know that there's no problem with regard to people here, but I do know that they need to be arrested. Yeah, as you do this group debrief, let's point out we had a good open discussion of this whole matter, and try to get a position that is we think permanent. I think it'll be a pretty good position. I think you'd be pleased with it. I've start going with a script tonight. I'd like to take, if you would like, 5 minutes to have Admiral Moore here in the morning in court. I think you might find it interesting. You didn't catch your nap, did you?
No, sir.
I'm sorry. Would you like to just...
I can deal it out and talk.
Fine.
If I may, before, sir, you mentioned the Navy capabilities, I'd just like to say that the Soviets recognize the importance of the oceans to us in the economic, political, and military sense. Therefore, this momentum that the Secretary of Defense talks about in building up their capabilities aimed at testing the submarines, which are designed to prevent us from using the oceans and to interdict our LOC. So I think if our Navy has an area which which requires attention, again, as anti-submarine warfare area.
And I strongly suggest in this instance, here's where I depart from some of my friends in the diplomatic area. From anybody around the table, others, very strongly that to the extent they are willing to play any kind of a role, the British play by nature. While we must maintain, for example, our same attitude in regard to South Africa, I think the defense arrangements would have to do with it. Have in mind the fact that they do add to our capability.
That's right.
Let's put that first rather than the domestic political situation.
Yes. If I may, sir, report on the operation in Laos. Over the weekend, as you know, they have been going quite well in the sense that the Southeastese have been into the general area of Siphon. The troops have been in there. They have uncovered large caches in the vicinity. The contacts continue. There's a sharp fighting going on. We have reports this morning, for instance, that such things, they found 25 enemy bodies, 114 enemy bodies, 112 enemy bodies, and the combination of the number lost by the enemy in the Laos operation and the operation in Cambodia now, about 10,000, and a large amount of equipment, as we discussed yesterday, sir, the caches have been found in our Siphon area, larger than we anticipated. And they found just this morning again a very large cache of 82 millimeter ammunition. Now, looking to the future, it appears that the enemy several regiments have been hurt. We know that. But nevertheless, they do have a large force in the area, and consequently, I expect that they're going to concentrate on this intersection of 9 and 92. That seems to be the area in which they are talking about the most, and an area in which they tend to be moving forces up to operate in that area. This is being watched very closely. General Abrams reports that the morale of the Southeast is high, particularly since they have been in Siphon. That seemed to give them a particular satisfaction, since that was their president that made a point of this. So far as inside North Vietnam is concerned, the enemy has been doing what General Abrams calls angle biting along the road Highway 9, which we're using, of course, to bring up supplies overland. And generally speaking, sir, is going well. We expect very hard fighting in the days ahead.
Mr. President, I think that's the important thing to bear in mind, that this operation is going along according to the plan, but we're going to have some hard, tough fighting on the part of the South Vietnamese during this period of time. We don't run too damn fast. The first day we have a real tough, hard battle, because we're going to have some of them.
What about the fact that the enemy is being severely hurt? It's on his own home ground, where he had all the advantage.
Now, one question to think about for a moment. Because of the press has played off this Siphon as sort of a victory, identified it as the victory of Siphon. I assume we're going to get, the South Vietnamese are going to get out of there after a while. We want to be sure then it isn't played up as a defeat.
Keep stressing the point.
Wait just a minute. What are the plans of South Vietnamese in the next month? So are they going to gradually move away from that area? Should we start maybe giving out public that...
Of course, the reason for going to the area in the first place focuses on the series of roads, primarily Highway 9.
I understand that, but what about the... We want to make it appear now that the fluid condition, they're going to move around, not necessarily stay there, but in other words, it shouldn't be considered whether we hold Siphon or not.
That's a matter, yes. We ought to look at that area.
Could I say that I raise this question with everybody here, with Bill, with Mel, and Warren Henry. Basically, the great mistake of commanders through the years is, as you, Admiral, as a student of military history, know, discuss some sneaking city or objective, sometimes great cities, sometimes small cities, and so forth, and then they as a result of their obsessions on those cities, they suffer great defeats. Napoleon was taken to Moscow, of course, was a very great mistake. I mean, there was nothing there that he could, that he had already would lick the Russians and should have gotten out. The Germans made that same mistake in Stalingrad. The Germans made it in World War I, and their enormous losses they took were done, even though the French took a great number of losses as well, and so on and so on down the line. Without getting to the military history, this is a pipsqueak little operation, 2,000 people, whatever it is, but because of the play, the television, and the rest, here's Chacon, sober. 3 weeks, the television has been saying the South Vietnamese are bogged down, the military has lied to us, the president's lied to us, because he said we were going to get Chacon, and we didn't get Chacon. And then, all of a sudden, I didn't know it was going to happen, but right after I went on television, said that we were something I had confidence we were doing reasonably well, and generally it was good. So they get it enough of me. The line, it seems to me, that should be taken, and should be taken. And it's difficult to take it because they'll try to twist it another way, having in mind the fact that their interests are quite different. It's quite interesting for me to note that, for example, that the Washington Post, 3 weeks had Laos on the front page. The day, Saturday, that they took Chacon, you had to go to the 12th page to find a little bit more. Now, the reason for that is not that the Washington Post is particularly trying to. Anybody tries to prove that his views about what was going to happen are correct. Now, let's not make that mistake. Actually, our views about Chacon were always stated to be that it was not an objective. That our purpose was disruption, that Chacon happened to be simply a crossroads for several highways being true, that we're going to go in and disrupt. I think the line that must be gotten out immediately is, yes, they moved into Chacon. After they have accomplished their disruption, they will move out. Now, maybe they'll move out in 48 hours. Maybe they'll move out in 2 months. But the main point is that the purpose is not to get Chacon and hold it. The purpose of going into Chacon was to go in and tear up the place and then get out, but lay the foundation now so that when they do move up, whether by choice or by necessity, instead of letting move out as a result of our saying so, that's really the point that needs to be. And if you do that, you're in a pretty good position. And actually, I think they're going to be able to stay quite a while, what you told me, but if you want them to stay. I don't know what you want them to stay.
Well, we want them to flap out.
I don't want to have to lie publicly, but nevertheless, the point is that and we all want to be able to be perfectly truthful when we say anything, but the point is that, as far as I understood, Chacon has never been an objective in itself because there's nothing there.
No, so I think we can point out that they wanted to check for the caches. They found very large caches. They've been destroyed. They are moving on.
Right. And that the plan always was to move out and not to capture it and hold it. That's the point.
Not to occupy, but to move. The idea is, and we got to keep hitting that across.
Well, I think we all have. I think that's going very well. I really, the question I was asking, I didn't understand the nuances, but whether they are going to move on in a few days. If that is the case, then we ought to sort of make that fairly clear, because otherwise then it's going to look as if they were forced out. If they're not going to be moving out in a few days, then it seems to me our line should be a little bit different, that we expect they will move out eventually. But I think there's some advantage in knowing whether they
are going to move out. Can I comment on that?
Yeah.
Right from the original briefing on this particular operation, Saigon, the idea was, if the force is massed in there and they get into a position where we can hit them from the air and make them serve the destruction of the forces, we will do it. But the idea is to use the South Vietnamese military to the best advantage in each case to attract the enemy to mass, which they haven't done in the past in any of these operations. We're kind of doing in reverse what they did to the South Vietnamese for a number of years. we may move out of there in a week if it's to the advantage of the South Vietnamese and to this military operation. But you have to look at the situation as it develops.
You can't answer those questions directly. We have no plan yet. It'll depend on the circumstances.
It depends on the circumstances that develop. And that's why we have to keep going.
If I understand all those things, what I'm making is, if we do plan to move out, we need to be days and days to start laying foundation there.
No, there's no plan to move out in the next 48 hours.
Well, they just
three or four days.
They're not going to move out there. They may move out of this one little...
I think this much can be said. I think it should be said. Bill will be saying something, and Bill will, I think, we're going to go on.
I think this speaks pretty soon, and it's better to form words.
Right.
I think in this case, if we don't know, we just play the way the president said.
But I can say the purpose is destruction, and the purpose is not. Well, let's face it. South Vietnamese are not in Laos for the purpose of capturing cities and holding territory. They're there for the purpose of disrupting communications, supplies, etc., etc. Once that purpose is accomplished in any area, they will move out.
And that's really what this sounds
like. If you say it that way, then Japan, sure. Well, they tore the place up. There's nothing else left. Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Situation where we're not over dependent on the Middle East.
first thing to do is to get Alaska going. Now, we're on dead center on Alaska because of all the talking that's being done by the people who are concerned about our harbor. The question is, who, what groups or individuals are respected in the, we want to start talking a little bit about the importance of Alaska and on. Sure, you can get the archivist to do it, but nobody believes it.
Yeah, that's right.
Who is there, the, or the, again, situation to.
I have a feeling, perhaps, on this entire government, as I saw an article the other day, and on top of that, I was out at the Salk Institute and had a professor from some place in Environment or someplace, one of the West Coast University, one of the big ones, and he was a Nobel Prize winner, and he talked about the myths of ecology. He made a very, very vivid talk of terms how we're overdoing it. He referred to the said that this is like the, he used the expression like the Vanderlog. You know, and Kipling and Vanderlog, they get excited about the monkeys getting rid of their big other stick, and then the biggest goddamn stick, and everybody's going to sit behind that stick, and then somebody drops it and says, and they pick up another stick somewhere along the line. And so it is for this academic area. They're now about all pollution and ecology and all that sort of things. And I have a feeling that there are some objective people amongst the scientists who can really take a look at this thing. Because there's been a comment, there's been so much doctrine there, and SST, that maybe something moving in that area to really have an objective.
Yeah, where was this problem anymore?
Nobody can get it. Oh, we have a whole set of examples.
We need to get some of these people in the public believe talking about our energy
system. Yeah, sure, sure, but that
man. We're in a hell of an energy
crunch. Yeah.
We've been this for 4 years to sort this one out.
Yeah,
we've got so much lead to us.
Where else? I suppose you can't use maybe Rockefeller because there's oil.
Yeah.
Maybe
you use Council on Foreign Relations as oil.
It's established, yeah. I don't know whether maybe if you could use labor in this thing. Well, this means jobs, it means industry, and they are fairly close to the earth. In regard to this, who the fuck is that? I don't know if I can talk to you. They would know who he is. And he, by the way, on this committee, labor, that I think is a thought. The Act of Missions of Labor. Some of these, maybe I use the TV, perhaps a little bit on this, but the TV people playing up the other thing so heavily. I could probably get CBS to put on a program that would be really, let me make one of those real studies, you know. I get a hold of Taylor, who several times has done some things like this. Well, those are the offhand. But when you talk about Alaska oil, somebody told me the other day, you'd know this better than I would. Oil fellows talking, and I was talking about this same thing, but I still forget it from the point. And he said, Jack, you know, the most fantastic estimates as to what the potentiality of the reserves in Alaska so far are about one-third of what they are for the
known reservatory in the ship's going along.
Yep. Do I give you the
time?
Sure, time. We have the energy in our own country and in this hemisphere, and we get going on the technological. We have the coal, and we have the shale, and we have the tar sands. You know, the price of oil, I'm investigating these holes. Probably going to have slapped on the rest of the raise the price of oil. The midst of inflation, the price of crude is getting to about the point where it's economic to shape. It reflects the environmental aspect.
What is involved in the environmental shape?
As I understand, it's the rubble you leave around.
Am I getting a person?
We never, in fact,